so doggone blue to listen to that old smokestack. Drivers are rolling on, leaving me here behind. Give me back them good old days and let me ramble down the line. Hear that lonesome train, I love to hear the whistle blow. She's taking the sun and leaving the rain and making me want to go. I've got the blues, longing for her company. Many miles from where I am to the only one for me. It's so lonesome here, waiting for the manifest. I hope that engineer is kind enough to let me be his guest. Old pal to me, take me everywhere I want to go, get my transportation free.
Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WAFT Champagne, 90.1 on your FM dial.
And Dave on the board, it is Sunday, April the 7th, 2019, and this is the Prairie Monk Show, WEFT's weekly look at rails, trails, greenways. It's actually green out there, yay! There's some kind of tree that's already got little tiny petals coming off of it. Do you know what that is? Something is actually, it almost looks like snow, unfortunately. But anyway, there were little petals coming down and getting on the street as I was bicycling over here. And this is our look at the environment, too.
And it's sort of cloudy day, but we'll be wandering around. We have a visitor today. It's my niece from Australia, but she's an appointee here in Washington. So she's visiting for a couple of days, and we've been running around. I have some local stuff to do first, so we won't waste too much time doing that, because she has a lot to say about the world in general, and we want to use that time. I want to say that it's dust time. Part of the News Gazette building, the building has been bought by Cofusion, and there are three hi-hos, very big hi-hos, starting to take that building down. And there will be dust. And this week I had a conflagration with dust. I was almost not getting enough oxygen in my chest to make my body work. So I'm on steroids at the moment. But I warn you that there's dust here. You may want to move away from it. I may even have to take a hotel room to be away from the dust. But be warned. There's been a Boneyard Art Festival, pretty huge program. Goes on and on and on. I have a copy here. Thursday was campus. Friday was champagne and a banner. I think Saturday was involved with both places, and they ran over. And we had an exhibit that Patizio on Lincoln Avenue. And it's still there. And the leader of the push, each year they select a a special person to be represented on the flyer, and his name is Chapman, and he was at that site too. Just enough to let people know who's doing what and where, and we may have more to say about that in the future. The city had a wonderful meeting of the art talent that is in their office staff and planners and citizens that belong to the community and to the library. And they started off 5 o'clock with a celebration there. And then I went to the Grand Prairie Friends. Very concerned about the Grand Prairie Friends because they're doing very well, but they've morphed away from their original mission, which was to preserve prairie in a situation where prairie doesn't have any advocates caring for it. It is very hard to find original prairie. It's along the railroad lines, and this is 10,000-year-old stuff, not replanted prairie. So there are some replanting, and that helps education, but it's not enough. Then we had the advertisers. We have stuff on Facebook, and it's been quite amazing. So I had an attorney here with Seja, and they came as a result of Facebook. We talked about prairie preservation, and then we took Seja to, he couldn't come on a Sunday, so we took him to the Urbana Public Television, that is really very cooperative and help us with us. And he, between WEFT and UPTV, we've been able to do things and put them up onto YouTube, but we need to be on a medium like Facebook to allow people to know more about us, so that rather than being quiescent with Facebook, we need to be active. And the result has been people coming or people reporting on the Facebook and then registering with other people, and so it goes. And it has been a fall of interesting stuff. So the Art Tucker, who's been encouraging this, I think is pleased with the results. So we have to figure out how we can do that. So there's some engineering and concern, and David will be involved with that. Cope Compton had a meal for us, and the discussion was kind of interesting. So I'm going to, without further ado, introduce Marilyn. I'll ask her to introduce herself to some extent, because she started out in the Navy, and she's sort of graduated to a different format of life. She has a husband who's been getting a degree on the internet, innovative folk. Some of the Australian universities are doing that, and she has a small child. And so let's launch into Marilyn. She's quite capable of speaking for herself. So onward and upward, make sure you don't get the superstructure across your face.
Thank you, Dave and Dave, for having me. This is my third visit to Champaign-Urbana, and I just want to say the cities have grown a lot. Just even Dave's street that he lives on is the development here is pretty impressive. So we enjoyed the Boneyard Festival yesterday and a few other things around the town, and I hope to get to see a little bit more before I head back to Washington DC tomorrow. But Dave did say, yeah, so I'm his niece and have been living in Australia pretty much most of my life, but I've had a defence career, started in the Navy, and that has taken me all over the world. And plus I like travelling, so, and I like travelling to the United States, so we've been here a few times. And one of Dave's friends yesterday, Bill, reminded me that he first met me here 20 years ago, which, time flies. But recently, about the last 16 months, I had the opportunity back in Australia to move out of I was in the logistics support sort of sustainment field of the defence, and I got an opportunity to take an exchange position in Washington, D.C., in the Pentagon, which is pretty cool for someone who only used to see that building on television. And I now work with the US Department of Defense, working with the relationship with Australia, noting that the two countries are very close allies and have supported each other for just over 100 years in pretty much every sort of major conflict in the world. So I'll probably say a little bit more about that in a minute, but you did mention my husband, Kieran. He was good enough to pack up everything and come with me, which was nice. And he's still in the Australian Army, and we're doing what's called a flexible work arrangement with him. So he still is an active member in the Army, and he does a lot of stuff via computer now, and still contributes, but also has the opportunity to be in another country working from home. So a lot of workplaces are allowing this flexibility now. And we take it year at a time, but so far they've been really receptive, and that's been great for him. And in the meantime, for the last 4 years, he's been doing a degree by distance with the University of Armidale. And it's allowed him to have exposure and the opportunity to study where he didn't have to, in a sense, give up his work to do that. And that's tough. Quite regularly, he would do a full work day, come home, eat dinner, and then go and lock himself in his study and have to write an assignment or get ready for an exam. But he did it, and he's really dedicated, and I'm really proud of him. So he completed that late last year, and he's now signed up to continue his education through a master's program, so through the same thing. So that's I suppose one different way of doing it. He's a guy who will openly tell you he didn't finish high school. He joined the Army, and then as a mature age student, he's found that he's got quite a lot out of it and rounded out some of the skill sets. He's also been really lucky that through his working life, they did recognise prior learning for a lot of the subjects, which meant he didn't have to do the 4 full years. And they've done the same for the master. Very much so. On the job, his active service, the leadership and the development, the training that he's done by writing those skills up, I think it's worth taking the time. It's sometimes hard to do that recognised prior learning process, but it's worth it. And it means you're not rehashing subjects where you've really got life experience in those areas. Yeah. So that's been good. And then we got a little guy, Jackson. So last time I was here, he was in the back of our minds that we might go and have a child. But he's cool. He's a little 4-year-old. He goes to a pre-K program in Clarendon in Arlington. And he's learning Spanish as part of the everyday school. They teach them Spanish in the classroom there, and he's learning to read and write and knows his numbers. He's the best negotiator I know at the age of 4. But I think that'll set him up for some pretty good life skills as he gets older. So that's us.
You've been lucky to be an experiential person too. You've learned a lot of your trade by doing.
That's it. So I was not the best student, much to my mother's disgust. But I finished high school and then attempted to go to university in Australia. It's a college equivalent here. But after about a year or so, I decided it really wasn't for me. I really like the hands-on doing, learning by actually doing. So I joined the Navy and spent 12 years there. Then I sort of went into the logistics field there, and that then took my career post the Navy into the civil servant world. So I still work in the defence environment, and I found that quite rewarding and managed to do things and have opportunities and work with people. But in the service under the rank structure, I probably wouldn't have had that exposure. Still no formal training as such. I did a few certificates along the way and associate diplomas. I did a couple through RPL, just literally recognising my prior learning, and they gave me the certificates to boost my resume. And then when this opportunity, what I'm doing now, came up, I couldn't put anything in the formal training box that related to the international field that I'm now in. But my exposure and my understanding of Australian policy in respect to where the Defence Force was heading, and also the Australia's sort of reconstituting their sovereign capability and doing a lot more things in the country. An example is the manufacturing of cars has ceased in South Australia, and so now they're looking at building ships and submarines down there. It's not exactly the same, and there's a bit of a skills gap, which they're working out how to train the same people who worked in one field and now worked in the other. But there's an opportunity, and so that environment and economic growth down there has been quite impressive. They've also been rebuilding a new shipyard, which that's posed all sorts of environmental challenges. And I can say that in logistics and defence now, there's been a real change in the last number of years where you think about the environment that you're operating in when you're doing your planning up front.
Is your harbour at the advanced edge of the Murray River Basin? Does the river come out of...
Yes, it connects down there.
And it has some dry out problems because people further back on the river... taking water out of
they do the New South Wales and Victoria, that the river runs all the way through the three states, and poor South Australia gets the dregs sometimes. Yes. Which is it's something that's looked at national level,
and that affects shipping too.
Yeah,
the water level and the erosion that goes on
very much so. So then I applied for this job working over in the States, and now I spend my days working in an international office which deals with all the countries that the United States has arrangements with, and I work looking at the Australian perspective, which is quite a different level. So I have exposure to ministers and senior politicians within the Australian government, and I've had small little interactions with some of the seniors on the US side at sort of like Secretary of Defence, Undersecretary level. And I'm just a small town girl from Albury in New South Wales, Australia. So I do definitely think myself lucky, but I will say I've had some really good champions over the years who have sort of seen skill sets and recognised them and said, you should put your hat in the ring for this job. And then one of the things... I think a lot of people could take a lesson learnt from, I suppose, is you got to back yourself sometimes and just give things a go. And if study's not your bag, well, then work out another way to get where you want to go without having that piece of paper as such.
It's a little bit like doing prairie preservation. you can't do this as an academic thing, but... going into the field and reacting with people and interacting and bringing them together and suggesting things would actually happen is very...
And you've made a life work out of it, Dave, and you're still going. It was interesting yesterday, Dave actually met me at Paxton on the way down from Chicago, and we then went visiting some of the sites where the prairie, it's clearly there's signs saying, you know, this is a preserved prairie, and at this stage of year it's not a lot of the
flowering doesn't
flowering
come.
Hasn't come yet, but yes. Just it's still there and you can see it. And it's
all burns.
Great to see that it's being looked after and treated appropriately. There was a lovely little cemetery which there's a prairie along up until one area, but then there's this patch of land that is unclaimed at the moment, or I think we would like to get as part of the prairie.
Yes, we have a 9-acre prairie on that 10 miles of corridor, and next door to it is another 8 acres.
That 8 acres backs onto one of the prettiest cemeteries I think I've ever seen. It was stunning.
A nice little rise.
And to fill that gap in, to make that a sanctuary for prairie officially, would be a really nice little thing. And then another, just an experience of dealing, and I have this a bit every time I see Dave, is we went to the quilting festival yesterday, which was amazing. The quality of the quilts for the...
Cunningham Children's Home.
Yeah, and they had a lot of people there, which was great for the children's home there to get that funding and donations. But the we were just randomly looking at a quilt, and someone just walked up to Dave, who hasn't dealt with him for a number of years, and went, "Are you that guy that preserves prairies? And you know, helped me learn this and that all these years ago." So I think that's not done in a classroom. That's done out and about.
Yes.
Getting your hands dirty.
Yes.
In the weeds as such. Yes. So, yeah.
So, yes, and we'll continue through to have a look at the Kickapoo Trail, which is my big worry for this weekend has been to listen to people talking about cemeteries, talking about cicadas, talking about bumblebees, and where are they? They're on the railroad bed. They're not in a forest with a reconstruction prairie. This is 10,000-year-old stuff that we're concerned about. It's been maturing ever since the world warmed up some and the glaciers moved out. So the moraines are still there, and we have the opportunity to preserve little pieces of prairie along the railroad beds, and I really would like to see the trails narrower on from St. Joe into Danville, just to preserve that biological genetic material that is almost extinct. People think that they're doing wonders with prairie by reconstruction prairie, but you can't put 100 species, broadleaf species, back into a replant prairie. You can't get the bacteria and the fungi and the small mammals in there. So I've been tempted to say and to remind Grand Prairie friends that they were put together basically to preserve prairie when there were no other advocates for prairie. And to morph off into a forest has brought them million-dollar respect. But there are a lot of agencies that work with forests. We don't have people who work with prairies, and we desperately need that sort of thing. And actually, Marilyn comes from Albury, and the Australians have rails trails too. And they have vegetation on the side of those trails. And one of these days when Marilyn goes home for a while, I'm encouraging her to think about other aspects of her career, where she has leadership capabilities, and to put together little things like her family farm, dairy farm, backs onto one of these rail trails, and there's a bridge very nearby, a very curly bridge, and there's a dam that has been created, so there's water and flooding. So working with these things and providing a little bit of education as well as recreation. So recreation is big deal, but the preservation of the biology is important. And I have to say so every once in a while. That doesn't get me any friends and relatives, but that's all right. I still am dramatically opposed to those sorts of organizations that we put together to preserve prairie, morphing off into forests that are so easy. So you can plant 1,000 trees, but still not preserving the prairie, and we need to make that sort of statement.
Yeah. And so I'm sure you made your point when you met with them the other day, and hopefully one or two of them out there have listened and might take that away and have a bit of a think and go,
yes,
hey, let's get back to the grassroots.
Because they have lots of volunteers, and this goes back to communicating. And so a lot of the work that we've done is to be inspiring people to do it, and they will do it better than we do. But we have to be careful to not have that drop back into tradition and not do what we want. So we have to be ourselves leaders. The Heartland Pathways has to actually do things and talk to people who want to put a trail in, but if that trail goes in and it's wide, there'll be no prairie left, and that's when you're down to 0.01%. That's a very small amount of remnant prairie that's been preserved. We need to do something about that.
Well, I think we tried to do our little bit yesterday back onto the Facebook topic. I use Facebook a lot for connecting with my family and friends back home, noting that we are in DC and away from those people. And I think the world's a small place with things like Instagram and Facebook in existence, and if used correctly can be a really good tool. So I tagged the Prairie Monk yesterday when we were out looking at one of the prairie sites. And stuck it up on his Facebook page. So I think it's a good thing that he's got some friends who are encouraging him to do more in that space, and it makes the world a smaller place. And we were talking this morning about networking and the fact that jobs and roles and things that can areas where you wouldn't expect to end up in or maybe share some expertise in come up sometimes just through the people you meet and the network connections, and just sitting down and having a coffee with someone who you might think on face value have nothing to do in connection, but then when you get talking, it's like one thing leads to another. And I'm sure you've found that a lot in your career. Yes. And I've definitely found it in mine.
Well, my nephew, we put stuff up on Facebook, and within minutes he had responded in Australia. So Rod was right there.
So, and I did the same. I managed to share some pictures of myself and Uncle Dave with the family back home, because at the time difference was that we were about to go to bed, they were getting up. They could see it, like it. And we even FaceTimed with my mother last night, which... She was hoping to come back to the States and maybe come up here again, but she keeps complaining about getting older and it's a long trip. And I challenge her and go, yeah, you'd be right. But well, at the moment, that's how we communicate. So I think it's a good thing, and hooking up the family and making sure those connections are still there is also important.
Yes, I'm glad to have Marilyn here and finding out what she does and how she gets involved in policy. It may, she'll be taking about 8 or 9 U.S. personnel to Australia, and so you will be interpreting in the Adelaide area.
Yeah, it's one of the, we have big bilateral discussions every year, and we're looking at taking a delegation down south to do exactly that. My remit covers science and technology and innovation, as well as the actual military equipment as such. And what's been really good to see over the last couple of years being in this defence environment is Australia's contributing to a lot of things that in the past we mightn't have been cutting edge or didn't have the core expertise. And then other countries are looking to Australia, which has only got 29 million people, can really only live around the outsides of the country, only a small population in the middle. That's a really big achievement. So they're looking at those countries
becoming more self-sufficient.
Yeah,
and independent.
And becoming subject matter experts or cutting edge in technologies which would traditionally be in some of the bigger countries in the world, which that provides opportunities and brings more people to the country, allows for more employment. So, you know, leads to all the positive things.
So I'm dreaming as to what you might do. So we have a snowy mountain.
This meeting isn't a case of just take them around. It's very well organised and very
but
planned.
But this is part of the organisation, that snowy mountain provides the water that goes down to Adelaide.
I get that.
And so these people need to know what the ecology is. You have a mountain that sends its water out to the Pacific Ocean quickly. So they have dammed it in several different places, and the water goes down and it goes to irrigation areas, and then it ends up in Adelaide, which is exactly where they're going to put
the
shipyards.
So
how will your 9 people understand the Australian ecology?
Well, unfortunately, I think the mindset of what their trip's for I'll be able to interject certain aspects of the climate and the culture, and just even explaining that it's a different time zone and we're going to a different season. I know that should be, oh, really? Like, you know, a known thing, but it's not. If you've lived in the US and only the US, when you say you need to travel to Australia and you need to leave on the Friday to arrive on the Sunday, they look at you as though you're strange. It's like, well, there's this thing called the dateline and you're crossing it. But a lot of people don't have that experience or exposure. So I suppose I will start a bit smaller. I won't be able to take them to...
You won't be taking them to Australia.
But we will be looking at how the dockyard and the... they've got to punch in something like 400 pallets into the inner centre swamp to build this dockyard. Pylons, I think they're called. And just even seeing how they've protected that area to develop this shipyard is going to give them a little bit of an insight into the area.
So will they be looking at mangroves and trees and plants that are growing in the swamp that you're going to fill in with pallets?
Well, they did take... they've actually cleared a lot of that out, but they've been protective of some of that area when they created this land. And they've reclaimed a lot of... swamp area, which was just barren. There was nothing there. It had been destroyed already.
It's the sort of thing that you get at the front side of the Mississippi. The rivers run out and they bifurcate so that you have this pad of swampland. Mm. And it's very important because it takes the brunt of things like hurricanes if you exterminate it completely, you're in bad shape when you have a hurricane that comes through.
And there's some other things that Australia's doing, which we actively do with the United States when we do things like exercising, where ships transiting barrier reefs. It has a lot of restrictions now as what you can and can't do in that area.
Yes, the Australians have been putting coal through the barrier reef, and eventually it goes to China. So. And there's still, it's money.
Well, they have a trading relationship there, yeah. So if you look at it from the political policy stand of view, there's both sides of the argument as to why that coal's going that way. But I suppose looking at just the fact that the barrier reef is getting warmer and it's not surviving.
Starfish and other...
They're trying to work out ways that we don't add to that. Even in Sydney, just the water shoreline in places like Clovelly and some of the DY areas where the water used to only lap up to a certain area and now it's coming a lot higher. Australia's definitely mindful and aware of that and it has good policies in town. I heard the other day some areas in the United States are going plastic bagless at grocery stores. Well, there's areas in Australia that have been like that for years. And if you don't take your bags, you walk out with your groceries in your hand. That is definitely not what happens. My grocery store in DC, if I have a gallon of milk, which has a handle and I can carry it, they will put it in a bag. Get two
heavy
bags. But I'm like, but I can carry this. Or there's a trolley that I can carry. So we try and bring our little bit of not overusing plastic bags that don't get recycled in just our everyday life in Washington.
So often military bases, they have ranges for ammunition, and so Woomera is such a place. So often the services have reserved, by happenstance, a lot of our natural history. So I'm hoping that your docket that is militaristic, that they're taking people to Australia, will have an ecological base.
Well, I'll try and inject it where I can, but I do think we do look at things now. Shoalwater Bay is an area in Queensland where they do a lot of exercises, and when they exercise in that environment now, they spend a lot of time about making sure that they leave the place the way it was when they come. So human waste, things like plastic water, even so that whole area, Pacific Islands has a lot of tsunamis and earthquakes down there.
There's one island between Australia and New Guinea, which has just been inundated because it was about 3 feet higher than the water, and the water's come up, and the hurricanes have come through. And
it's not a case of if, it's a case of when. Right, that's the way they plan now.
Right now.
So, but then there was a thought process of, well, we better get clean water in. We better take bottles of water in. And what was happening is there was no thought process of then how to get dispose of all the plastic bottles when it had all been used. So another group that I'm attached with is like a logistics forum that is international. It's got 31 countries in it. And we meet three times a year in various locations. I went to Samoa last year for a conference, and then Tokyo last year, and then this year I think it's actually in Port Moresby in September, which I haven't been there since they did a lot of the development for the recent APEC summit. But that group looks at it from a country perspective to how can we help each other, because that whole region is literally supporting each other in respects to a tsunami or an earthquake. And they think about those things of how to get fuel in safely, how to then get it out, how to get rid of the water bottles or the human waste when you bring all these people into a country to help support because they need the medical attention or whatever. And I think that's a really positive discussion. And some of the smaller nations are able to say, we don't need this ABC, we need DEF. And by having those discussions,
what
at
is
the whatever the items is, like, don't just expect that the country needs bottled water. They might be good for that. Ask the country what they need before you come on in there with all your guns blazing, in a sense, to say, well, what position is the country in and what do you need? Do you need more medical aid? Do you need more food resources? So those discussions, I think that is a positive for me, looking and going, wow.
So you've been
people
to Samoa?
I have been to Samoa.
And it's split in two. Part of it is American front.
I haven't been to American Samoa. I've been to Samoa, like the traditional part.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. They're different administrations and
very much
policies.
So. If you look at Fiji, Samoa, Vanuatu, all the islands have got their own individual culture and traditions, and some match, some don't. And then being Australian, we quite regularly have a multicultural society where you have people who have migrated from these countries into the population, and they're just part, they now call themselves Australian, but they might have a dual citizen with their other
country.
That
has changed since the 60s, but until then, Australia and New Zealand, it was a white Australia policy. They didn't want people from the north coming in, and you basically have a Anglo society. In Australia, it's more convict and background. In New Zealand, it was more landed gentry, and the soils were different, and the quality of the soils in New Zealand are different from, and from a tourist point of view, you've got hot pools and you've got snow-clad mountains. You have to take account for the difference in policy that comes with it. now, you have a calamity like Christchurch, and so there's a whole bunch of policy there. The Maoris are different. How can you? They're Southeast Asians, and how do you handle this? This delicate stuff.
It's ongoing discussions at the moment. There's a lot of policy and talk. What happened in Christchurch recently was horrible, and there's been some pretty swift action to make some changes down there on what is already quite tight and stringent policy in certain areas. Australia's about to have its own election I think it'll occur in May, so that'll change possibly the dynamics of what's going on there. But I don't know, you just try and do your own little small little bit and hopefully affect that it's making change in the bigger picture.
Some attitude to firearms. 20 years ago, a friend of mine had a daughter that was in her 20s, but she was an attorney, went to Tasmania, and somebody decided to shoot up 30 people. And at that time, they went around Australia and collected firearms. It was kind of huge. They left people who needed firearms with them. But now, 20 years later, they've done the same thing. And so there's a different policy to... The Australians don't operate quite the same way as the NRA here, the National Rifle Association. And sometimes it involves funds. Do you sell firearms to different countries and then fight with them? It's difficult stuff, as I said before.
It's a very big big topic which you could spend hours and hours talking about. But it's I'm quite proud of the policy in Australia and what we've done there. And it was a big move at the time for the Prime Minister at the time to put the amnesty out and take change the way the rules have done. But it's something Australia did. A lot of people say, why can't it be replicated around the world? Well, every country has their own sensitivities and issues, and you mentioned funding. So I'm not going to advocate that that should happen. It's more of a case of I'm proud that Australia did.
But as a policy leader, you have to be game sometimes to speak up.
Yes.
And even if you're in a minority. And that's part of your talent, is to be there and remind people that there might be a different idea here. And so we find the same thing in the natural history territory. We have to be prepared to speak up every once in a while.
I think we bring, so the Australians, the way I view my role in DC is I bring a different perspective and a different way of looking at things. So sometimes you can get caught up with the, well, why do we do it this way? Well, because we've done it that way for 50 years. I think the fact that they've got an outsider inside the international community here gives a different viewpoint, where I can say sometimes, why don't we do it this way? And it might not always fly, but it definitely sparks the thought process to then see what is in the art of the possible, but is maybe not completely out of the box, but maybe operating a bit more in the grey. And I like that. I think that's a good opportunity in somewhere where I can value add, and then in turn we part some knowledge and we cross-pollinate the way the United States does things with the way Australians does things. DC is a different environment because you barely meet anyone who's originally from Washington, D.C. A lot of people have come into the city, and in turn it brings a massive dynamic of different people from just even different parts of America. I met someone the other day from Nebraska. Mm-hmm. I've never met anyone from down there, over there, west, right, Midwest. So there's, and I still look at my map, which I have in my office with pegs all through it, and I feel pretty lucky. I've visited 31. I added them up the other day. I've been to 31 states in United States, North America, and there's many more that we want to get to.
Well, so you even watch the sports. And you're in Virginia, and Virginia is on the top of the
Virginia. Well, what is it? I think they might have even got through to the last two. I think final four. Final four was on yesterday. And so the basketball is very big, hot topic. And I'll shout out, sorry for everyone who's different hockey fans here, but the Capitals. My husband has jumped onto the Capitals bandwagon, and we go to the hockey quite regularly. We enjoy it. We don't have a big league in Australia. They do have one in a place called Canberra, which it's getting a bit bigger, but the sheer size of it and what these guys do and the money involved and the shenanigans that go on with the things of the Stanley Cup, it was pretty cool to be in the town when they played that and won it last year.
You just had Bill had two mayors, one from Urbana and one from Champaign, Finan and Marlin, and there's a hockey team proposed. We don't have a ice hockey team. But Champagne is thinking about $9 million and developing between University Avenue and Springfield and through with the mass transit place so that they can have a big venue where you can have 1,000 people and you can have a big hotel where everyone is in the same place. So yes, we're into sports and indirectly into income that comes to Champagne.
Yeah, it's a lot of money. Tickets aren't cheap, but I think the Capital One Arena that they have in Washington is sold out regularly, and it's used nearly every night of the week, whether it's a concert, it's a stage show, whether it's a sporting venue.
Multiple use.
You've got basketball one day and it's an ice hockey ring the next day, and then it's a stage show for someone the following night. and it's easy to get to when everyone goes there. So that's nice. Then the other side of the coin, there's a Birchmere, which is down in Alexandria in Virginia, and it's a small little playhouse which has been having musicians come into it for, forever. You look at the wall and some of them back in the 60s and they get the smaller gigs. And I recently saw an Australian artist, Casey Chambers, who she plays there and comes through quite pretty much every year. And it was nice to sit in a packed small playhouse to listen to someone who I used to listen to growing up. So I do enjoy the versatility of Washington, D.C. My son is a massive fan of the CS Space Museum and the National History. That the ability in what the Smithsonians do in that town, city is unbelievable. You can't go many places where you can see so much collection of history in one place, and you really only have to do a small donation to get in the door, and you don't even have to do that. It's the stuff he is learning as a four-year-old in the United States. We may have had a little bit of an exposure to do in somewhere like Sydney or Melbourne, some of the major cities in Australia, but not a hey, what do you want to do today? Oh, it's Saturday. Let's go to the CS Space Museum and see, touch a piece of the moon, or look at the spacecraft that's actually been in space. So we are taking the opportunities. We spent probably the first year really seeing DC and the mall and the flexibility of it's a very friendly biking city. It's a very friendly animal city, so he brought our dog with us because he's our second child, and Kieran's best friend when he's working at home, and Charlie can pretty much go everywhere with us. He can go into hotels and stay the night with us. Australia isn't that progressive in certain elements there, and in turn they've been smart environmentally to put places around where you can take your dog to do what he needs to do when he's not damaging someone's garden or an area where they're trying to keep it pristine from things that dogs do. So I think that's positive, and I do enjoy the seasons there. Our backyard, we quite regularly have squirrels. We don't get too excited about them anymore. We have cardinals, we have deer, and they just sit and take a nap in our backyard. Wow. I still get blown away by what's in that little area with a major city with like the White House just across the river. It just sort of blows me away.
So rude question. My wife is a director of a Southwest Institute for Research and Wellness. She's retired, but she's been here recently. But can you say something about the role of women in the Australian forces and in your policy?
In the policy,
are you a seldom person? Are you one in the crowd?
Funny. Yeah, it changes. So back in Australia, in my era, I did work in a particularly male-dominated field. Moving up into the role, sort of touching out of Canberra now, it's not 50-50, but it's getting close. There's a lot more women. The head of the shipbuilding program has just been appointed. She's female. The head of the sustainment of shipbuilding Australia is also female. Our Minister of Foreign Affairs has been female for the past two, and they're both extremely impressive women. When I came to America, North America, the office I work in is predominantly females, and what I found so refreshing and a little bit strange, because Australia's got a bit of a tall poppy syndrome where we occasionally have to knock each other down just because that's the nature of the pulling the mickey out of each other, but there's a fine line there. But this office is mostly females, some highly educated, some...
But on the support level.
No, they're in roles dealing with other countries, and they're on the forefront. They take the meeting, they run it, they organise it, they have a number of support personnel, and we all get along, and we're all really, really, yeah, it's a cool group. My immediate is an ex-ambassador to Kosovo, and she's now the director of the international organisation I work for, and then our undersecretary is female. So,
do you find a policy difference?
No, I think they're there in their own right, and they've worked hard, and I think that's the whole thing with it. I don't necessarily agree you should have I know some people have the whole, it should be 50% female. Well, if there's not 50% female but don't cut the mustard, I don't want to be put in a role because I'm not... I want to know that I should be there
because
I'm doing a good job, but I really wished it wasn't the focus. I think it's great to see hearing the mayor of Champaign and the mayor of Banner, and listening to them as both quite competent women who said that they'll still be a mother and a wife and a profession the next day if they weren't mayors was so quite refreshing.
Often the forces are leaders in policy, home policy, like the inclusion of black people, different ethnic groups. They seem to have a positive policy to husbands being involved.
Definitely. So Australia, I think, is quite open to that. We're a little bit slow on a few things. They literally only had the gay marriage law came into about 18 months ago now, but the military is not exclusive of anyone, and it's a small little community. You'll find if you go traveling around, you'll know someone who was in the military who lived in the small town that you then were from. Like it's on such a different scale to the United States. Like, as I said, 29 million people compared to 300 and something.
Australia has about the same population as the state of Illinois.
Yeah. And it's and that makes a difference.
And it's the same surface area.
Correct.
As the United States.
Yeah.
But the United States has soils that are glaciated soils that are tremendously wealthy. Or rich, and it has water at the right time of the year, and it has wealth that Australia doesn't have.
Very different climate down there as well. I jokingly say that I'll never be cold in Australia again, and I've lived through two DC winters now, and that's not even a tip of the iceberg compared to what you guys deal with here. I was feeling for you all when your polar vortex was coming through a few months ago. And so there's some pretty hefty weather conditions that you guys have to deal with year in, year out.
So what will you do when you retire from this sort of thing? Does this keep you going for another career?
So it's a little bit funny. I'm here for anywhere between another 2, if not 3 years. I need to do some networking and some work out where I'm going to fit back into the organisation in Australia, because I don't think financially I can retire just yet with the four-year-old who gosh knows what he's going to get up to in the next handful of years. And I like being busy, and I don't think I could sit at home every day, all day. But I do enjoy and believe in what we do in the defence environment. So I think the defence environment, either being part of the public sector or within the defence industry, is probably somewhere where I'll end up. But I'm open to whatever is going to happen.
Do you think that they might
give
you a year's sabbatical?
Well, I think, well, the education piece is something that, even though I haven't gone down that path, I do think it's important. And there's a couple of areas that I might want to do some higher education, and if they do have opportunities in Australia where people who are in full employment are sent to a college. They've got a national shipbuilding college. They've got a university at in Canberra where they send the executive level who are handpicked, and they go and sit in a classroom for a year, and that is their job, and they come out with the master's at the end of it. But the exposure and the program they develop is really world class, and yeah, if that was put in front of me, I'd definitely have to consider it.
Now, you mentioned that the unit that you're working in has a diverse education background, some of them with advanced degrees, some of them with no post-high school degrees.
Very much.
So maybe you can get by without that. Is it useful? Is it mostly just a piece of paper that you can say, yes, I do have that piece of paper?
I think it comes into play when you really want to go higher up the ranks. We don't come from a culture where your child, and this isn't a dissing the culture within America, but it is very much a case of you will go to high school, you will then go to college, and you will then go and be employed, and you do the various steps along the way, internships or whatever. Australia's a little bit more, you need to have a job, you need to be able to support yourself. But the TAFE, which is sort of the blue-collar level, welding skills, electricians, plumbers, that is a really big area. But it is not a bad thing if your kid finishes high school and they choose to go and be a carpenter. You don't necessarily have to go to university, or as we call it, college, straight after high school. That can these days, the flexibility, particularly on the internet. Kieran literally listens to his lecturer online from wherever at whatever time, and then they make certain times available where he can ask questions and go back and forth with the person. He's never physically been to the University of Armidale. That ability these days is, and flexibility is something that a lot of people are then taking up when they want to maybe specialise or get to that real higher, more senior level in their field.
And that sort of sabbatical allows you to meet with people who sometimes have a lot of clout.
Yeah.
They may have a ticket, but they have much more than that. They are multi-dimensional, and they can work with a twinkle in their eye, and you can belong to that.
Yeah.
And that's exciting when you get a team of six of those people. Then you get to do things.
And the networking then from that is that's that exposure and opportunities in different fields. So I'm not wedded to anything. If you had have asked me 20 years ago, would I be back here working in the States, I would have probably gone, oh, maybe as a pipe dream. So I think overall, if you've got a passion for something and you're keen to get out there and work whatever field it is, because I think you need all sorts of types to make up this society, go for it. Give it a go. Back yourself. surround yourself with people who support you and maybe not always agree. You know, you got to have that fun balance there. Mm-hmm. And you guys can, world's your oyster. So
it's changed a lot. Your mother's era.
Very
did
much
not
so.
Get to do as much as it's a very traditional homebody.
And as much as she's probably not stoked I'm living in another country, she did raise me with the fact that you can do whatever. She didn't mind that I was out with the boys playing or swimming in the river or all that sort of stuff. And I think that's made me who I am today. So she will keep in contact and make sure she's still. She knows she's done a good job, and this is the way. There's no limits for boys or girls as you grow up these days.
Thanks very much, Marilyn Tomlinson. And
thanks for having me.
And
might not be 5 years next time. We'll try and come a little bit more regularly.
We have to do a lot of things with our own neighbourhoods. So thanks for being on, and this has been Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk. WEFT Champagne.
And Dave on the board. As always, the views and opinions expressed are solely those of the speakers and